Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights and Free Speech and Election Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Tuesday, August 9, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Please note that all expressions of opinion on this call are those of the experts on the call, and note that the call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert Hans von Spakovsky. He is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and without further ado, I will turn it over to him. Hans, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. It's been a very busy couple of weeks on the issues of voter ID in the main, but also some other issues such as early voting and same-day registration, as well as out-of-precinct voting. What's happened in the last 3 weeks is that courts in four states have all issued decisions either throwing out entirely voter ID requirements or limiting their use or ordering certain remedies that we'll discuss with regard to voter ID laws. And also there have been decisions about changes in early voting. As I said, also the elimination of same-day registration, et cetera. Before talking about those cases, everyone should kind of understand the legal background and precedents that we already had on these issues. I mean, for example, the first voter ID case actually went to the Supreme Court back in 2008. That was a case called Crawford versus Marion County. The challenges there were claims that requiring a photo ID in Indiana was unconstitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision in 2008 saying that requiring a photo ID was perfectly constitutional and, very importantly, that it was not an unreasonable burden on voters and, in fact, really wasn't any different than the tangential burdens that voters undergo anyway to do things like register to vote, transport themselves to the polls, etc. That was a 6-3 decision. Included among the justices was Justice John Paul Stevens and Justice Scalia. That's an important factor because, of course, Justice Stevens has retired since then, and Justice Scalia, unfortunately, has passed away. So the solid majority that said that there was not a problem with voter ID laws is no longer there on the court. And almost the same time that this constitutional challenge was made, there were challenges filed to the almost identical voter ID law that had been passed in Georgia back in 2005. That was filed in both – there were challenges filed both in federal court and state courts in Georgia. The state actions claimed that requiring a photo ID violates the state constitution. The federal case claimed that requiring a photo ID was a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that it was discriminatory both in intent and because it would have a discriminatory effect, that it would supposedly suppress the votes of African-American voters and keep them out of the polls. That case went through 2 years of litigation. In the end, the state lawsuit was dismissed. The federal lawsuit was also eventually dismissed. The judge issued a ruling saying that there was no evidence that the law was either discriminatory in intent or effect. So the law went into effect and has been in effect in Georgia for the past 8 years in election after election. Same is true in Indiana. It first went into effect in 2008 and has been in effect now for many elections. It is interesting to note, just kind of as a sidebar to all of this, that you know the same claims were made in Indiana that this would suppress votes, particularly of African Americans and Democrats. In 2008, when the law was in effect in the first presidential race in Indiana, Barack Obama actually won the state of Indiana. He was the first Democrat to have won the state since Lyndon B. Johnson in 1964. that the cases that have been filed since then have challenged the North Carolina law, Texas, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. So let me kind of talk about these in turn. The Texas case was a challenge to the Texas voter ID law. Texas, just like every other state that has implemented a voter ID law, also will provide a free ID to anyone who doesn't already have an ID. They have put in other measures to make it even easier. In Texas, for example, if you need a birth certificate to get that free ID, the state won't charge you for the birth certificate. So they put measures like that in place. There's a long procedural and complicated procedural history for the Texas case, which is called Veazey versus Abbott. In essence, a federal district court judge in Texas found that the law was discriminatory in intent and effect under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. She also claimed that it was a prohibited poll tax, which was a little odd given the fact that you could get a free ID. And it went up to the Fifth Circuit. A three-judge panel initially said that basically threw out all of these claims other than saying it would have a discriminatory effect. Because the Supreme Court during the last election basically held that in abeyance, the law has been in place in Texas for several years. In fact, it was in place in 2013 for a state constitutional election. It was in place for the 2014 election. So we actually have turnout data from Texas on what the effect may or may not have been of the law. Information about that turnout data was actually not brought into the case by the challengers to the law, even though they were claiming that it would suppress turnout. The reason for that being that that information did not help their case. In fact, it hurt their case. In the 2013 state election, turnout went up dramatically in the state in comparison to a state constitutional election in 2011 when the voter ID law was not in place. And in fact, it went up at a higher rate in some of the Texas counties with very large percentages of minority voters like Webb and Hidalgo counties. The law was, while it's been referred to as being very strict, it actually had very broad measures in it. For example, if you needed to get the free ID, there were 28 different kinds of supporting ID that could be used to get a voter ID, including everything from school records to W-2 forms to Medicare or Medicaid cards, immunization records, tribal membership cards, etc. But most importantly, the turnout data did not show that there was any problem with people actually getting to the polls. It's also important to note, and this is something that eventually was noted by the dissent of the Fifth Circuit, and I should mention, three-judge panel decision was vacated. It was considered en banc by the Fifth Circuit, and that is the decision that we got just 2 weeks ago. In that decision, the court said that this law did have a discriminatory effect. They did toss out the discriminatory intent finding, although they said, well, there was some evidence of that. They simply said that the district court judge relied too much on old history, and they returned it to her to do new factual findings on whether there was an intent to discriminate. They didn't toss out the law in its entirety. They said to the district court judge, you need to fashion a remedy for the small number of individuals who don't actually have an ID. Since this case 2 weeks ago, the parties in the case, the state of Texas and the many plaintiffs who were involved, have actually worked out a joint agreement on the case. I believe they're actually having a hearing very soon on this. And under that interim agreement, the parties have agreed that any individual who has not gotten one of the free IDs will be able to vote if they are a registered voter and present a series of different kinds of documents, anything from a voter registration card to a current utility bill, a bank statement, a government check, a paycheck. Basically, these are the provisions similar to the Help America Vote Act, a federal law that says that states are supposed to, the first time someone registers and the first time they vote, require some kind of ID. And that list of documents, from utility bills to government checks, et cetera, are straight out of that HAVA law. So as long as someone shows at least one of those items and signs a declaration that they had a reasonable impediment that kept them from getting an ID, they'll be permitted to vote using a regular ballot. That settlement has not yet been approved, but that's what the parties have agreed to. What is fascinating about that, which is the allowance that someone will be able to vote if they sign an affidavit saying that they had a reasonable impediment that kept them from getting an ID, is that that is exactly what the North Carolina voter ID law had, and that entire law was just thrown out by a three-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit. That is a case called NAACP versus McCrory. And North Carolina, what North Carolina did is they put in a requirement saying, one, you have to have a photo ID to vote. We will give you a free ID if you don't have one. And finally, if you show up at a polling place and you don't have an ID, including you don't have the free ID, which the state's willing to give you, if you sign a form in which you declare that you had a reasonable impediment that prevented you from getting an ID, you'll be allowed to vote and your vote will count. That's the agreement Texas has just worked out with the plaintiffs, but the three-judge panel found that to be discriminatory and a violation of the Voting Rights Act. That's a clear conflict. It's also a clear conflict with another prior case called South Carolina versus Holder that was issued in 2013 by a three-judge panel, which included, by the way, one of the Fourth Circuit Court judges. That case was about the fact that South Carolina had passed a voter ID law. That voter ID law was passed while Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was still in place. The U.S. Justice Department refused to pre-clear the law under Section 5, so South Carolina went to court, sued the Justice Department. A three-judge panel was assigned to the case. That three-judge panel basically reversed the Justice Department's position and said it was not discriminatory for the state to require a photo ID law. South Carolina had exactly the same provision that said if you don't have an ID, you'll still be able to vote if you sign a form that says you had a reasonable impediment that kept you from getting an ID and voting. So, you know, that decision is 2013 saying that's perfectly okay under the Voting Rights Act, yet now we have a Fourth Circuit decision saying that, no, even with that kind of a reasonable impediment exception, that's discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act. The Texas case has a very interesting dissent written by Judge Edith Jones, joined by several of the other judges. The reason that case is interesting is that she points out that if you look through the multi-thousand page record, there was not a single trace, much less a legitimate inference of racial bias by the Texas legislators. And we should say the trial judge actually gave the plaintiffs in that case unprecedented access to the communications of all of the Texas legislators, all of their internal communications in a way that had never happened before, and yet the dissent says there's no evidence of that. Also, she points out again that the plaintiffs, including the U.S. Department of Justice, were unable to produce a single witness who was going to be unable to vote or had been unable to vote because of the voter ID law, which had been in place for several years. So that is a point that really tells against what the majority found in that decision. Going back to the North Carolina case, in addition to voter ID, which was the only issue in the Texas case, also at issue in the North Carolina case were a series of other reforms that have been made by the legislature in North Carolina. Not too many years ago, the democratically controlled legislature had put in same-day registration. That is a concept where you can register and vote on the same day. Only about a dozen states in the United States allow same-day registration. Every other state requires you to register prior to Election Day, anywhere up to 30 days before the election. They also changed the amount of time you can early vote in the state. It was 17 days. There were complaints about the fact that polling hours were not uniform across the state, that there were discrepancies in where those early voting sites were placed. And so the legislature cut back the number of days from 17 to 10, although they kept the number of hours. The counties have to have early voting sites open exactly the same, but they also provided there has to be more uniform distribution of the early voting sites so that one party or the other does not get an advantage by where these are placed. The state also had put in the concept of out-of-precinct voting, which is something that almost no state follows. Everyone, I'm sure, knows in your state you have to vote in the precinct to which you are assigned. You cannot vote in a different precinct on the other side of the county, for example, where you live. South Carolina had put in allowing out-of-precinct voting. The legislature in 2013 got rid of that and went back to the traditional method of precinct voting that is the standard rule in almost every state across the country. The Fourth Circuit said that all of those changes, cutting back the number of early voting days, getting rid of same-day registration, not allowing out-of-precinct voting, all of those were discriminatory under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that the legislature had acted with an intent to discriminate, and it would obviously have a discriminatory effect. Now, the problem with those claims is a few things, such as the actual data on turnout in the state. And I mention that again because that's very important. The federal judge in this case had written a 500-page opinion upholding all of these changes and saying they were neither discriminatory in intent nor effect. Because he had refused a preliminary injunction when this case was first filed back in 2014, these laws were in place, these changes were in place for the 2014 election. So we have actual turnout data to look at in the state to see whether or not it actually had a discriminatory effect. We know it did not because in the 2014 midterm election, in the primary, for example, the turnout of black voters went up almost 30% over 2010 when the old rules were in place. By comparison, the turnout of white voters only went up about 14% over 2010 when the old rules were in place. There was also an increase in the general election in 2014. In fact, they had record turnout. The percentage of the black voting age population who voted in 2014 was a little over 41%, whereas in 2010 it was only a little over 38%. And the number of registered blacks who voted actually went up from 2010 to 2014. Nationwide turnout actually dropped in the 2014 midterm congressional elections when compared to the last midterm congressional elections, which was 2010. The national average turnout across the country dropped about 5 percentage points. North Carolina was one of the few exceptions. In North Carolina, the turnout actually went up 1.7 percentage points. So any claims that these changes had a effect on black voters to suppress their votes, to keep them out of the polls, was clearly untrue. In fact, with regard to the same-day registration being gotten rid of, to currently in North Carolina, black registration is 91.2%, whereas white registration is only 83.4%. So blacks are registered at almost 10 percentage points higher than white voters. So I frankly have read the North Carolina decision. I really don't understand the logic of what the courts are saying, what the three judges are saying there. Similarly, some of the decision parts of the decision are really ill-informed, and I'll give you a quick example of what I mean. This voter ID law and these other changes were passed by the Republican-controlled legislature in 2013. That was after the Shelby County decision. The judges put great stock in that and said that clearly they wanted to discriminate, that was the reason that this law was only passed in 2013 after the Shelby County decision was over. What the judges apparently ignored was the fact that Republicans had only taken over the legislature, I believe, in 2012, but they had been trying to pass a photo ID law since 2003. In 2003, they put in a voter ID bill. They did the same thing in 2005, 2007, 2009, 2011, and those laws were blocked all of those years until 2013. So the idea that they suddenly got this idea and obviously therefore wanted to discriminate is simply factually unsustainable when you look at the record, which the court, I think, really kind of basically ignored. That brings us to Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, we are back to constitutional challenges to both the voter ID law and to some other changes that the state made. What's odd about this most recent case, and it's called One Wisconsin Institute versus Thompson, is that, look, the voter ID law in Wisconsin had already been challenged. A district court judge had decided that it was unconstitutional, basically ignoring the Indiana case, the Crawford case. That had gone to the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit overturned it. That didn't prevent the challengers from filing a new lawsuit saying that the law was unconstitutional as applied. There were actually two lawsuits filed. One judge found recently that the law was unconstitutional and that individuals had to be allowed to vote if they simply fill out an affidavit saying, yes, I am who I claim I am. I think that case basically is thumbing its nose at the Supreme Court precedent. That is also true of the One Wisconsin Institute v. Thompson case. There, the judge found the voter ID law to be unconstitutional. He also found many other changes that the state made to also be unconstitutional. And let me give an example of what I mean. The state changed the durational residency requirement from 10 days to 28 days. What that means is that under the old law, you had to have resided in the state for at least 10 days before you were allowed to vote. They changed that to 28 days. So you have to reside in the state for 28 days before you were allowed to vote. The court said that the state could not make that change, that was a violation of the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. The problem with that is that the U.S. Supreme Court has already ruled on that issue twice. In 1972, they issued a decision in Dunn versus Blumstein. I happen to know that case because Blumstein is Professor Blumstein of Vanderbilt University School of Law. He was actually my constitutional law professor when I went to Vanderbilt. And as a young law professor, he moved to Tennessee to take his job at Vanderbilt and discovered that they had a very long durational residency requirement. I don't remember exactly. I think it was something like 6 months. The Supreme Court issued a decision saying you cannot have that long of a durational residency requirement. You can have up to about 30 days. And so they tossed out what Tennessee had done. But 30 days is okay, and yet this court in Wisconsin is saying that 28 days is unconstitutional. There's actually a second case from 1973 called Marston versus Lewis, in which they actually okayed 50 days under the special circumstances of that particular case. And yet here we have a federal court saying that changing from 10 to 28 days is okay, even though the Supreme Court has said slightly longer periods are constitutional. Again, I think the judge is really thumbing his nose at the Supreme Court. Similarly, Wisconsin changes law to say that municipalities can only have one location for in-person absentee voting, you know, prior to election day. Again, the judge said that's unconstitutional to limit in-person absentee voting. It's unconstitutional under the First and 14th Amendment. Again, the problem with that decision is there is a U.S. Supreme Court case on absentee ballots from 1969. And in that case, McDonald versus Board of Election Commissioners, the U.S. Supreme Court said you have no constitutional right to an absentee ballot, period. That may be a surprise to most folks, but that's what the court said. Voting by absentee ballot is a privilege. Now, we all know every state provides absentee ballots, particularly for people who may be out of town or ill. But the point is, while the states do that, they are not required to do that by the Constitution, even though from a policy standpoint, it's a good idea. And that's what the Supreme Court has said. So if that's the case, then how can a state limiting absentee ballot locations for in-person voting to one location, how can that be unconstitutional? I mean, that's similar to the problem in the North Carolina case where the court said, well, only having 10 days of early voting as opposed to 17 days of early voting is discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act. Well, here's the problem with that. Early voting is a relatively new concept. Texas was the first state to put in early voting back in 1988. Today, there are still at least more than a dozen states that don't have early voting at all. You have to vote on election day, and that includes states like New York. It's hard to imagine that you have either a constitutional right or a right under the Voting Rights Act to early voting when that's something that is relatively new, that many states don't have, and that the court has already said you've got no constitutional right to absentee balloting, which is very similar to what early voting is. Similarly, the idea that if a state doesn't have same-day registration, that you are somehow violating the Constitution of the Voting Rights Act is, I have to say, I think it's really absurd, and there's really no legal credibility to that claim. Again, going back to the North Carolina case, there the court said that getting rid of same-day registration was discriminatory and a violation of the Voting Rights Act. Only about a dozen states across the U.S. Allow same-day registration. Every other state requires you to register prior to election day, and that has been the traditional rule in states who, under the Constitution, have the right to run their elections. That's been the rule for many, many decades. To suddenly say that if you don't allow same-day registration, you're violating federal law, under that opinion, more than 30 states, the majority of states who don't have same-day registration, they are suddenly violating federal law or acting unconstitutionally. It's similar to the final thing in the North Carolina case, which is the North Carolina Fourth Circuit said not allowing out-of-precinct voting is a violation of the Voting Rights Act. Only a tiny minority of the states allow you to vote outside of your precinct, and that's a relatively new rule. The rule has always been that you have to vote in the precinct to which you're assigned. There are very practical reasons for that. If you can vote anywhere in a county, then county election officials have no idea how many ballots should be assigned to each precinct. They assign ballots based on how many registered voters are there. Sometimes they reduce that based on prior history of turnout. But the point is, if you can go anywhere, it's very likely that some places will run out of ballots because they have no way of knowing how many people will show up. The other problem with out-of-precinct voting, of course, is that the ballots vary depending on where you vote in a county, because you have different members of city councils you can vote for, different members of the state senate, depending on what districts you're in, which congressional district you're in, et cetera. They cannot stock all the different ballots that apply in a particular county all in each precinct. And if you show up in a precinct where you normally would not vote, well, yes, you may be able to vote for president. You may be able to vote for the U.S. Senator, because that's going to remain the same wherever you are. But you won't be able to vote for all of the local races that only apply in the district to which you are assigned. So there are many practical reasons for this. But the point is, again, under this Fourth Circuit decision, every state that doesn't allow out-of-precinct voting can be argued to now be violating the law. I'm going to just mention another case, but just briefly, because I don't think it has the kind of precedential values other cases have, and that is, we also just got a decision from a federal court in North Dakota. This case is called Brakehill versus Yeager. In that case, the federal district court said, with regard to the state's new voter ID law, that they have to provide a fail-safe provision for Native Americans who don't have an ID and can't get the free ID under the law, despite the fact, by the way, that the law says that a tribal membership card is sufficient to meet the ID requirement. Now, the reason I don't think that case has that much presidential value is because of something fairly odd that I don't think I've really seen before in a federal court, and that is, if you read the judge's decision, on page 7 of the decision, the judge puts out in boldface type, which you don't often see in federal district court decisions, he says the following: "It is important to note that with respect to the plaintiff's request for injunctive relief, none of the affidavits, declarations, surveys, studies, or data submitted by the plaintiffs in support of their motion have been challenged or refuted by the state of North Dakota." On the very next page of the opinion, the judge kind of summarizes the claims made by the plaintiffs in this case with regard to Native Americans who don't have ID or didn't know about the ID requirement and can't get an ID. And again, in bold face, at the end of that summary, the judge says, "The defendant neither disputes nor challenges these findings." So it's very clear that the Attorney General of North Dakota didn't actually put up a defense. I mean, they certainly appeared in the lawsuit, but they really didn't put up a defense to the case. And that's very important for this reason. If you look at all of the other cases that have been filed challenging voter ID laws and other such requirements, the plaintiffs have always brought in experts who have made wildly exaggerated and huge claims of, you know, large numbers of individuals who supposedly don't have ID. That happened, for example, in the Georgia case back in 2008. There were claims that anywhere close to 600, 800,000 voters didn't have an ID. We know since then, in the 8 years of experience that the state has had, the number of individuals each year applying for a free ID has averaged about 0.05%, a tiny amount. Same thing happened in Virginia recently. Its voter ID law was challenged. It was upheld by a district court judge. When the voter ID law was first passed, groups opposed to voter ID put out stories and reports saying that anywhere between 800,000 to more than a million voters in the state didn't have ID. The law has been in place now for several years. In 2014, when the law was in place, which was obviously a midterm election year, the number of individuals applying to get the free ID was about 3,000 out of almost 6 million registered voters. So the number of individuals who don't actually have an ID has proven to be extremely small, and much smaller than the exaggerated claims made by many of these so-called experts. It's also worth noting that in the North Carolina case, for example, the U.S. Justice Department and the plaintiffs in the case actually brought experts in who claimed that black residents of North Carolina would not be able to vote because of the voter ID law, because of the changes in early voting, et cetera, because they were, quote, less sophisticated than other voters and therefore wouldn't be able to register and vote. I mean, I couldn't believe that when I first read it in the transcript, that the U.S. Justice Department was basically saying something that's so patronizing. And as we know from the turnout data, that proved to be totally and completely untrue, because the changes made there not only didn't depress the vote of African Americans in the state, as we now know, the turnout went dramatically up, and they are registered at higher rates than actually other voters in the state. Where do these cases go from now? The Wisconsin cases, the attorney general there has already said that he will be appealing those to the Seventh Circuit. I believe the Fourth Circuit case of the three-judge panel, I believe North Carolina is going to seek cert before the U.S. Supreme Court. What will happen at that court, we of course don't know, but I think it's important to note that only four of the judges, I think, would actually uphold a voter ID law and actually uphold the precedent of the Indiana case. I think the four judges who are generally known as the more liberal judges on the court, I frankly think they'll vote against any kind of voter ID law. So I believe we're probably going to have a split decision at best on any of these cases, which means, of course, that whatever decisions made by the courts of appeal will probably stand, certainly for this election and until and unless we get another member of the Supreme Court. So now I'd be happy to answer questions about any of the cases.
Great. Thanks very much, Hans. I'm now going to open the floor to questions. In a moment, everyone's going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your phone. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can go ahead. And we're going to answer questions in the order in which they are received. Right now, our lines are wide open. Again, that's star and then the pound key on your phone to ask a question. Here we go. We're going to go right to our first question now.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. In all of these cases that I've read, the court's argument in the plaintiff suing to overturn the voter ID requirements argument tends to be based on a statistical analysis saying that X class of people are less likely to have IDs. And on the other hand, they say the number of cases of actual fraud that can be proved are few and far between. But it seems to me that that is putting the shoe on the wrong foot. The statistical evidence and arguments for the facilitation of voter fraud are enormous. And I challenge the plaintiffs to come up with the example of one person anywhere who is eligible to vote who cannot get the required ID in time to vote. And let me tell you just a little story, if I might take a moment. I have worked off and on as a poll watcher in Chicago elections going back to when Jimmy Carter was president, nearly 40 years, and more recently as a poll watcher in the Scott Walker recall election in Wisconsin in 2012, I believe it was, which had same-day registration. And I literally witnessed cases in Milwaukee that were much worse than anything I have ever seen in Chicago, including the absolutely anomalous case of a polling place set up in a local YMCA, and obviously you vote in your local neighborhood, where to come in the main entrance and turn right to use the gym or the swimming pool, you had to show a voter ID, yet to turn left and vote, you didn't have to show anything. And sitting outside of every single ward, as they call their precincts in Milwaukee, was a car with Illinois license plates, with a community organizer, with a list of eligible voters and a cell phone, calling other people to round up anybody they could to get them. Some of them would just pull up, honk their horn. Someone would come out with an application to vote and a ballot already filled out, have the person sign it from the car window and drive off. So that is my commentary on what's really going on with these cases. And I believe that if we do not get actual evidence in the record in these cases, states are going to continue to lose them, and votes are going to continue to be stolen from honest voters, and their votes will be diluted. And that is the true deprivation of the right to vote in this country. End of speech.
Well, I say I agree with all of those points. I will say this. One of the problems with this area and the claims made by opponents to, for example, voter ID laws about voter fraud is that, first of all, they refuse to recognize all the different situations that voter ID can potentially prevent. And what I mean by that is all the studies that I've seen that say, oh, there's so few cases of impersonation fraud at the polls. Well, voter ID laws don't just potentially stop impersonation fraud at the polls, of which I have a number of examples. But they also could stop individuals from voting under fictitious voter registrations. There have been cases of that, upwards of, I think, 70 individuals at Acorn were prosecuted and convicted of that by states across the country before Acorn kind of dissolved. It also can potentially stop illegal aliens from registering and voting, although that's kind of going away because so many states now are issuing driver's licenses to illegal aliens. But we have many cases of that, illegal aliens and also, frankly, legal aliens registering and voting in elections. And the other thing is, when I do debates on this, often folks on the other side will at least admit that, well, there is a fair amount of absentee ballot fraud. But they say, oh, obviously voter ID can't stop that. Well, that's actually wrong. A number of states, this includes Kansas, Alabama, and actually Wisconsin, when they put in their voter ID laws, they applied it to both in-person voting and absentee balloting. So it can prevent all these. The other problem, of course, with this, and this was something that the Seventh Circuit said when it upheld Indiana's voter ID law, it said was, well, how in the world are you going to be able to detect this kind of fraud when you don't have the tools in place to do it? In states like New York, where there's no voter ID, how in the world are you going to know that someone came in and voted under someone else's name? I have a great case that, again, opponents like to ignore from New York, mid-1980s, a state grand jury report that was released by the DA after she discovered a successful 14-year undetected voter fraud conspiracy in Brooklyn in which they hired crews of people to go from polling place to polling place to vote in the names of individuals who they knew were registered but who were dead, who they knew were registered but had moved out of state, and they voted in the names of fictitious voters who had been registered through the mail-in voter registration system that New York alone had at the time, and which we, of course, adopted nationwide with motor voters. So all of those instances are things that voter fraud could potentially, I'm sorry, that voter ID could potentially stop. And same-day registration is extremely dangerous because there is no way to verify that the individual appearing to register and immediately vote is actually a resident of the state, that they're an authentic individual giving their real name. And if you somehow later discover when the registration card comes that you mailed out to their supposed address comes back because the U.S. Post Office says no one lives there at that address or there's no such address, it's too late. They've already voted. Their ballot has disappeared into the anonymity of the ballot box, and you can't do anything about it. That's why same-day registration, frankly, is a bad idea.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that. Before we get to one last question, I think, let me make a quick programming note. Our next scheduled teleform call is this Friday, August 12th at 2 o'clock p.m. It's on constitutional challenges to the America Invents Act. So let's get to our final question.
Hey, Hans, this is Jack Park. Thanks a lot for your report. I think it was this past weekend, the Washington Post, talking about the redistricting cases, pointed to a coordinated Soros-funded effort to challenge changes or redistricting efforts in a number of states. Are these attacks on changes in voting laws coordinated in your judgment?
In the same way. Yes, they most certainly are. In fact, Mark Elias, who was the individual I think profiled in the Washington Post story, he's a very well-known lawyer in Washington D.C. In fact, I think he's the general counsel for the Hillary for Clinton campaign. He has filed a number of these lawsuits. For example, the lawsuit against the Virginia voter ID law. I think he was involved in the Wisconsin lawsuit. Also, they have filed a number of these, and it was made very plain in these articles that. And I think he has said that he received several million dollars from George Soros or one of his foundations to finance all of these lawsuits. So what you have going on across the country is a general attack on all kinds of election integrity measures. And if you don't think that the groups involved in this, such as the League of Women Voters, the ACLU, the NAACP, that those lawyers aren't all talking to each other and coordinating what they're doing, I probably have some good swamp land in Florida that I'm happy to sell to you. But there is coordination going on, and the coordination is intended to prevent any measures that would improve the election integrity in the U.S. And look, a prime example of that is the fact that they are attacking something else we haven't talked about besides voter ID, and that is the attempts of several states to stop non-citizens from illegally registering and voting in our elections. Mm-hmm. That's why Kansas, Arizona, Georgia, Alabama, Oklahoma, I'm sorry, have put in provisions that say when you register to vote, you have to provide proof of U.S. citizen. They are trying to prevent that. Now, the only reason to be against that is because you actually don't want to prevent non-citizens from registering and voting, and you don't want them to get caught doing that. And that's just another sign of this general war on the integrity of our election process.
All right. Thanks very much to our callers with questions. Hans, I'm going to kick it back over to you in case there's some final parting thoughts that you'd like to express.
Well, the only thing I would say about this is the one final thing to say about these voter ID laws is I often hear from opponents, particularly during debates, they say, "Well, you shouldn't have to show a photo ID to exercise a fundamental civil right or a constitutional right." Well, the problem with that, of course, is that that's not true at all. If you want to exercise your Second Amendment right to buy a gun, You're not going to be able to buy one without having a government-issued photo ID anywhere. If you want to exercise your fundamental right under the First Amendment to petition the government for redress of grievances, so, for example, you want to exercise that right by going to the U.S. Justice Department and having a meeting with officials there to complain to them about their war on election integrity, you can't get in the front door of the U.S. Justice Department without a government-issued photo ID. And more fundamentally, look, the U.S. Supreme Court said in the Loving versus Virginia case back in the 1960s, which tossed out the ban on interracial marriage, thank goodness, that marriage is a fundamental civil right. Well, you can check the website of any place you live. I was in San Francisco over the weekend doing a debate at the American Bar Association, and let me read to you in San Francisco, which is probably one of the most liberal cities in the country, what you need if you want to get a marriage certificate so that you can exercise your fundamental right to get married. Here's a straight quote from the city's website. Both parties must present valid, authentic, legal photo ID card containing photo, full legal name, date of birth, date of issue, and expiration. And then in parentheses, it gives examples. Passport, driver's license, military ID, etc. Those are exactly the kind of cards that can be used in almost every other state that has passed an ID law. It's almost exactly the same as this, and yet you don't hear anyone complaining or filing lawsuits over the photo ID requirement to exercise such a fundamental right as getting married.
On behalf of the Federal Society, I would like to thank Hans von Spakovsky for joining us today. Thanks also to our audience and everyone who called in with questions. Again, please join us Friday at 2 o'clock for our next scheduled teleform conference call, Constitutional Challenges to the America Invents Act. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.